sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing with our next verses. As these women now have come to the tomb, things are not as they expected them to be, as we have seen, and they are no doubt in a state of shock, and that is going to be manifested by what the angel says to them. And entering the tomb. Some have been shocked here at the first words of this verse that the women would have the nerve to do this. But if one remembers that this was their intention in the first place, then this is not strange or unusual. Again, you've got a chi here that is not translated. Mark is very... This very much, by the way, is reminiscent of the Hebrew style, which uses a wow almost before every verse in the Old Testament. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And Mark seems to be reflecting a more Aramaic or Hebrew style of writing, even though he's writing in Greek. Having entered is eisercomai. That just means to go into. Eisercomai. Ercomai means to come or go, but eis makes it into. Having entered into, or after they had gone in. They've translated it like it's a present participle, but it's not. Into the tomb is ice again. And very often this is, we would call it a redundant preposition here because you've got a preposition attached to the verb. But ice into the tomb, menemion, again, no new vocabulary here. They saw, aorist indicative of eidon, anioniskos is our word. N-E-A-N-I-S-K-O-S. 11 times, this means a relatively young man. Primarily, it's used mostly to refer to people between about the ages of 25 and 40, in the sort of their prime of life. They saw a young man sitting. Kathemai is a present participle, indicating, again, ongoing action. That's generally what the participle is used for. This is just an attendant circumstance that they observe sitting on the right side, or at the right is the definite article plus dexios. And dexios means exactly that, the right or the right side. And it's a dative neuter plural, toward the right side or at the right side. But again, there's no indication, I've seen no real reason that the plural here is used, and it's often used with a singular meaning. So that may be some carryover from a Hebrew system of thought, why they would do that. Because very often Hebrew nouns and all were plurals all the time. And it was rare, like the word faces, as always it'll be translated face in the Bible, but it's almost always a plural. Because again, you don't have one face, as they would think. A waters is another one of those nouns that it's translated as a plural, a singular, but it's almost always plural in the Hebrew. And this probably seems to be one of those, in this case, adjectives, at the right side. He was sitting there, having been clothed, periballo, P-E-R-I-B-A-L-L. Ballo means to cast or throw, and peri means around. So it has the idea of throwing a robe around or some clothing. It's a perfect middle participle. Perfect means he had been clothed prior to the past, but he was still clothed. The middle indicates, of course, that he is involved in actually doing the clothing. Having clothed himself, we might say, would be the English way we would view that. Having clothed himself with a white robe, accusative feminine singular of stole, S-T-O-L-E, and that means a long flowing robe. And then leukos actually means white or bright. L-E-U-K-O-S, that adjective. Wearing a bright, and the idea is this is very bright, very white. Out of the ordinary white. And they were amazed. Ekthambeo is our verb. You got a chi there. And then this verb, E-K-T-H-A-M-B-E-O. Ekthambeo. Four times it's only used in Mark and only in the passive voice. It has the idea of being moved to surprise, perplexed, excited. The verb has a lot of, it's an emotional verb, as you might imagine. describing their emotional state. And he said to them, stop being amazed. And as a duh here, actually, that continues the thought of the narrative, then it might even be translated in a more temporal sense, a sequential idea. Then that one, or he, you've just got the definite article, that one says to them, present indicative of lego. Again, we see the historical present being used here now by Mark. And again, this is designed to draw the reader into the moment. He says to them, dative plural of the woman, the women, stop being afraid. Negative me, plus here, the same verb, ekthambeo, a present passive imperative. This construction, the negative me with an imperative, is often used to express the idea, it's a prohibition actually, to stop something that's already in progress. He knows their mental status. This also points to his supernatural nature. He knows how they're feeling. He knows exactly what they're doing and why they are there. He's been observing all of this for we don't know how long, but certainly the angels are observers of the human condition and watch as things unfold in human history. The angels are still learning. This might come as a surprise to people because you think, well, angels are so much superior to man and all of that, and they are. But they don't know everything. They're not omniscient. And at some level, they observe the plan of God unfolding just like you and I do. And they observe it from a different perspective than we do. We're involved in it as it's unfolding, and sometimes they are too. Angels have their own parts to play in all of this. And the word angelos itself, again, although not used here in this context, just simply means a messenger. And these function as messengers of God. They are called servants of positive volition, of those who would inherit salvation. And so they very often appear at key elements and key junctures of historical developments where God needs them. And as we might know, again, angels are very prevalent. They are great in number. We don't know how great. We know a third of them have fallen and are hostile to the plan of God and working against it. But the two-thirds of the other angels, you know, some of them appear to be in heaven. They can be dispatched to various places as they're needed. And these are the servants of God, and they delight, the elect angels at any rate, delight in doing God's will. And so he tells these women, stop being surprised or stop being perplexed. Do not be amazed. You are seeking, present active indicative. He tells them exactly what they're doing, indicating his supernatural knowledge. You are seeking Jesus the Nazarene. His proper name, Jesus, and then the one from Nazareth. The Nazarenos, the one who has been crucified. The definite article here, they don't really translate it. They translate it sort of by the word who, but it's the one having been crucified. A perfect passive indicative of stauro. Again, which means to stake. But it's a perfect indicating action in past time. Passive, he received the action of the verb. And the perfect passive participle here functions as a substantive. This is a description of Jesus that actually continues on in the New Testament. One might think, well, once the crucifixion was over, this appellation would not be used much. But it becomes a part of Christian history. And it's very much a part of the doctrinal teaching. Even in Paul's case, much later on, when he writes his epistles, he writes about the crucifixion not only as an historical event, but as an ongoing reality that governs the entire plan of God from the time it happened. So you are seeking Jesus the Nazarene, the one having been crucified. He has risen. Aorist passive indicative of egeiro. Again, the passive indicates someone else did it, an outside agent. He has been raised. They've translated like it's passive here, but it's not. Now there are other passages in which it is active. It says he has risen. But in this case, it's he has been raised. He is not here. And he gives these short staccato sort of statements. Don't be amazed. You're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He has risen. He has been raised, rather. He is not here. Negative u plus the verb I me. He is not. And then you have this adverb of place, hoda. H-O-D-E. In this place or nearby or here. Look, behold, is a particle, ide, and it's actually an imperative off of the verb horao, to see, and it means look, pay attention. Examine this stuff. Check it out for yourself. Pay attention. Look at the place where where they put him. The place is hotapos. We get our word topography. It's one of those things. It deals with places. The place where is an adverb, a relative adverb, hapu. Where they set or placed him. Tithemi means to set, place, or put. And then him is the accusative of autos, referring to Jesus. So one, as one might expect, and as seen in the verb ekthambeo, used in these two verses, the women have been taken aback by the scene they witnessed as they arrived at the tomb. Absent being there and seeing this and going through what all they're going through, it's hard to do real justice to this because there's so much going on mentally and emotionally with these women. And they are, again, still very much, no doubt, in a state of shock. Two, it is obvious that these women were still somewhat in a state of shock after witnessing the brutality inflicted upon Jesus, his crucifixion, his untimely and likely unexpected death. There's no suggestion to me, or at least I've never seen anything, that would suggest that these women were any more astute than the other disciples were. Some people doesn't seem that anybody wanted to get these doctrines about the crucifixion and the resurrection. And it doesn't appear that they wanted to get it. And so when this all happens, again, everybody is surprised. Everybody's caught off guard with all of this. Well, three, this has all happened quite suddenly and was something that was not expected by his followers, even though Jesus had repeatedly told them, we're going to Jerusalem. I'm going to be delivered into the hands of men. They're going to abuse me. They're going to kill me. And I'm going to be raised on the third day, or I will be resurrected on the third day. So when the subject of his destiny came up, it's clear that the disciples had rejected the very possibility any of his projections actually coming true. And I don't think these women were any different. I think they very much would have reflected what the guys thought. They seem to be a little more bold, and maybe they don't feel like they're in as much danger as the men would have felt, because when the Romans came out there, and not the Romans even, but the Jewish leadership came out there and arrested Jesus at Gethsemane, that spooked the disciples badly enough. But there's no indication that any of the women were around for any of this. There's no indication any of the women witnessed necessarily, like Peter might have, or John, the brutality at Caiaphas' place, the later brutality before the Sanhedrin. And then certainly none of them really witnessed, other than they could see the results of it, the Roman brutality of the scourging and the beatings prior to the crucifixion. So they don't seem to think that any of this is going to happen. They're shocked. It's stunning to them. And then when it does, they are all in shock. So again, the women might have been a little more bold in that they might not have felt that they were in as much danger as the men felt they were. But that's kind of understandable to me, because the men, feel that, hey, you are known disciples of his. You are known followers. We don't trust you. And of course, again, under Roman law, if Jesus was crucified, and he was, for anarchy, for sedition, revolution, the men, of course, in his group might have very well felt that they were going to be next in line. And I think there's good reasoning for that. Well, four, there does not seem to be any biblical reason to presume that the women who followed Jesus would have necessarily been more spiritually astute than the men had been. Although, again, you can't rule out that they might have gotten it, but It seems unlikely to me that they got it more than the men would have gotten it. 5, these women were obviously grieving and were experiencing the normal results of the death of a loved one. The first thing one experiences is shock or disbelief. Then one begins to experience other factors like denial, bargaining, guilt, anger, depression, and finally acceptance. But 6, however, at this early stage, the most likely emotions were still shock, disbelief, and anger. I mean, this would have, I think, drawn out an emotional response of anger about the unfairness of the situation. Normal people don't like injustice. Normal people think we have, as a part of our normal conscience function of mankind, for those that have normal consciences, that we don't like injustice. We don't like seeing people taken advantage of or brutalized that have done nothing. And it was evident to all these people that Jesus had done nothing to deserve all of this. And so I think anger is a very real part of what they feel. But again, disbelief, shock, and all of this other stuff. And then when they arrive at the grave to find it disturbed, it is likely that the matter of fear began to creep in. They don't appear early morning here. Now, they could have had some, but they don't appear to be too fearful at this point in their experience. It doesn't seem to me that they did. They seem to be pretty intent on their deal of going to the tomb and, as it were, embalming the body. Not that they're going to do a full embalming like that, but that's sort of the idea. And they don't seem to be afraid of anything at this moment. But again, now they get here and now things have changed dramatically, and I think fear is going to start creeping in. 7, perhaps they thought someone had an idea similar to theirs and had come to show their respects by further preparation of the corpse. Perhaps they thought someone had violated the tomb, stolen the body, or otherwise desecrated the corpse. These and possibly many other things were likely going through their minds. Point 8. However, it is clear that they did not know what was happening. That's the thing that stands out here is they're ignorant of what's actually going on. And 9, while one might be surprised to find that these women entered the tomb, it should be remembered that this had been their intention from the beginning. So that part doesn't shock me. I mean, you think, well, why would they go in given this situation? Well, that was what they planned on doing in the first place. And in fact, when they saw that the stone was gone, they may have just thought, hey, this is our problem solved. We knew we weren't going to be able to move it, and here we are. Well, 10, from John's account, it would seem that Mary saw the sight and jumped to the conclusion that the body had been stolen and ran from the area. It's very hard putting these accounts together. I mean, I've done the best I can with it, but the fact is, each one of them is focusing on a different thing, it appears. And a lot of things are probably happening, not exactly simultaneously, but very quickly. Things are happening fast this morning. And it came about on the first day of the week that Mary Magdalene came to the tomb while it was still dark and saw the stone already taken away from the tomb. And she ran and came to Simon Peter and the other disciple and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." Now, what you can tell that from that statement in 22 is that Mary was with other people. We do not know, but John doesn't mention them being there. He just focuses on Mary herself, but her statement indicates there were others with her that had seen this. Well, 11, however, Mark and Luke both record the fact that the women all apparently entered the tomb and saw the body was missing. Let's hit Luke 24:3 and then back to Mark. But again, Luke is the most vague. He doesn't tell us how many women are there or how many of them actually entered the tomb. They brought in the spices and they found the stone rolled away. But when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. And then in our Mark passage there in verse 5, as we've got, they entered the tomb. And then Mark, of course, mentions that they see this guy. 12, the fact that Mary departed so quickly betrays her extreme emotional response. Well, that I can understand. Again, while some people want to make Mary into a mental wreck or some sort of hallucinating psychotic, she's not. She's experiencing what I would think are the normal emotions. And because of the nature of her relationship with the Lord. I mean, he had cast 7 demons out of her. She apparently had come to him with far greater needs than maybe some of these other people. And Jesus, there was a verse where he essentially tells this guy, Simon, he said, well, basically, if a person does something for a person, and then they do something for something else, which one do you think is going to love him the most? And Simon recognizes, rightly so, well, the one who did the most for him, the one he did the most for. And so and he said, that's exactly right. So he who has been forgiven for much loves much, and he who has been forgiven little loves little. And there's sort of a correlation between the nature of the pre-salvation existence of people and how their life was and the recognition of how much grace God has bestowed on them. But the person that basically gets saved as an early person, as a child, and grows up basically in a Christian environment and all of that, doesn't necessarily feel the same in terms of gratitude for the person who was really drug out of the mire. The person whose existence was characterized by debauchery and a lack of restraint and these other things. And so Mary might be more emotional simply because she's had more of a relationship at some level with the Lord and felt more grateful than maybe some of these other people did. And that's, again, that's to me all understandable. But it also indicates, or it certainly appears to indicate, that she was not apparently not present for the angelic announcement or announcements. We think that there may have been one or two or even more. Well, the fact that she betrayed... Okay, so 13 here, actually Matthew's account would seem to indicate that there was an angel sitting outside the tomb on the stone that had been rolled away from the tomb. And however, point 14, that is only apparent. The angel had removed the stone and sat down on it while the Romans were standing guard. It was not necessary for him to remain there until the women approached. And he seems, presuming this is the same angel, and we don't know, there may have been more than one angel involved here as well. But it was not necessary for him to remain there until the women approached, and he seems to issue his command from inside the tomb. Matthew 28:6, he issues an imperative and says, come here. And that would appear to be from inside. Come, see where the place where he was lying. And again, what I would suggest to you in that between 4 and 5, there's a lapse of time that's not recorded. But again, as we know, these guys weren't, and it became pretty apparent in Mark, and as trying to harmonize these Gospels at some level, as you can, the chronology to them in these exposés of the life of Christ was not their primary concern. It was not their primary concern that everything was written out and all the time factors are recorded and all that. We see that they very much don't do that, in fact. Time, when you have specific time notations, it's helpful. But generally speaking, they don't. So I would suggest to you that between the guards falling for fear, shook for fear and became like dead men, and the women arriving, some time elapses. And so that angel's not necessarily still sitting there on top of that stone as he was earlier. And 15, in fact, it is evident from Mark and Luke that the women did not encounter the angel until they entered into the tomb. Our passage in Mark says they didn't see the young man sitting at the right until after they entered the tomb. That aorist participle means they had to enter the tomb first before they saw. In fact, that precedes the action of the main verb, saw. And then in Luke 24, 3 and 4, but when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord, and while they were perplexed about this, behold, 2 men suddenly stood near them in dazzling clothing. So again, as I pointed out to you, there appears certainly to have been more than one angel involved here. And maybe 3 or 4. I mean, we're just really not told. Did the initial angel that rolled the stone, does he remain further involved? Or after the Romans pass out and he departs, is his part done in this? We're really just not told. So from Luke's account, which does not contradict the less complete accounts, it is evident that the angel did not appear until they were inside the tomb wondering about what had happened. 17, although Luke and John both mention two angels being present at the grave, Matthew and Mark only mention one. However, again, the fact that they mention only one does not preclude two being present. We've seen that before in these Gospels where they will focus on what they deem to be the most important one or the most important thing to them when they write. And so we saw that, let's say, with those two demoniacs that came out of the tombs back in Mark 5. Only mentions one in Mark, but other accounts have the fact that there are two of them that come out. So again, this doesn't preclude two angels being present. 18, Luke describes the angels as being males. The Greek term aner emphasizes sexual identity. These were men as opposed to women. While Mark describes one young man. In fact, you can see the doctrine of angels, but all male angels are male. And all angels, you know, they're not these little cherub babies that, you know, would have on the Valentine's Day card or whatever else. They're all male. They're all masculine in gender. And they were designed, of course, to remain celibate and to live an existence, although they're still masculine, apart from sex. And the aner there, that term Luke uses, you would even translate it, well, they translated it two men, but two males is even better to emphasize sexual identity. 19, the Greek noun neoniskos, which is the one Mark uses, refers to a young man generally considered to be in the prime of life, being somewhere between 24 and 40 years of age. And now these angels, again, appear however and whenever they appear. They are immaterial beings. They are spirits. But they have the ability, apparently, to incarnate. Whether it's a full incarnation, obviously they don't take on a full human nature. They don't take on a sin nature. They don't necessarily fully take on flesh. But they appear to be able to manifest themselves. And when they do, most often they just look like normal men. And that's seen very early on, say back in Genesis there, where Abraham entertains the Lord and two angels, the Lord and Theophany. And it says that three men were walking along the road. And other than that, you would just think, well, they were just normal men. And then you come to find out it's the Lord, or it's the pre-incarnate Christ, the pre-incarnate Son, and two angels that are with him. Well, actually, I just cited that. Well, I didn't even think about it. Okay, since Matthew and John indicate that these men were angels, it becomes apparent that angels can manifest themselves in human form and appear as nothing more than ordinary men. And that's precisely how they appear there in Genesis 18 when they appear to Abraham prior to the destruction of Sodom. Now, we're told, and again, you wouldn't know unless you were told, the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, where he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. And when he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door and bowed himself to the earth to meet them. And so he extends hospitality to the Lord and these two angels. And then the Lord remains behind there. But in verse 16, the two men rose up from there and looked down towards Sodom. And Abraham was walking with them to send them off. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham's going to be such a big part and part of my plan, this is one of the principles of doctrine, that those who play a big part in God's plan oftentimes get greater revelation than those who do not. And there's a verse in Amos that says, shall the Lord not reveal what he's going to do except through his servants, the prophets? And so God reveals what's necessary or germane. And in this case, what he reveals is I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham knows Lot's there. So Abraham intercedes for Lot and says, look, Lot's a believer. These other people, they aren't. You can't treat them all the same, as if, you know, he needed a lecture from Abraham about how to run his universe. But this is an important point, and Abraham approaches the Lord and talks to him, as you do in prayer, and is very bold about this. And that's one of the things that doctrinal knowledge produces, is a certain amount of confidence and boldness. And so the two angels go on, and you're told they're not until later on, in 19:1. Now the two angels came to Sodom. That's the first time you're told explicitly that these men were angels. But looking back, you can see, okay, well, this explains all this. But again, when you see them calling to Lot in verse 5 of 19, they called to Lot and said, "Where are the men who came to you tonight?" They didn't recognize that they were angels. And so an angel can appear, and it would appear just naturally as a human. That seems to be the most common way they manifest themselves. So again, from Luke's account, point 21 here, it would seem that the angel simply materialized inside the tomb. I mean, you know, beam me down, Scotty. They didn't have a transporter, but they can do this. They can move around. They're not bound, apparently, by the time-space continuum. And while it's not a great movie, if you ever saw that movie Dogma, there's a scene in it in which they are clearly demons. Basically, one of them takes a hockey stick and rips the fabric of time and space and steps out of it. And they seem to have this power and ability to do this. So they're not bound by these types of things. So it appears that they simply materialize standing close to the women. Mark's account indicates that at least one of them sat down at some point. That's what we get in Mark's account, is that he's in there and he's sitting. Now, what Mark doesn't say, it doesn't say, was he there? It says after they entered the tomb, they saw him. You know, does that mean he was in there before they entered the tomb? We're not really told. He could have just materialized there. And again, if you're not freaking out already, you've got people suddenly materializing and dematerializing around you. This will shake you up pretty early in the morning, I would think. And so, again, what all are these women thinking? I mean, your mind would be racing so fast to try, what's going on here? What is happening? Well, 22, although some, Conrad and others, have suggested that this is simply a young man whose identity is unclear and open to conjecture. And this guy is probably the premier Greek scholar, and he can't interpret some of the most basic stuff in the Bible. Which demonstrates that, one, you could be trained and have all the tools. But if you're not positive, this is still going to be locked up to you at a certain level. God can still hide the truth. So this idea, well, if I just knew Hebrew and Greek and systematic and isagogics, I could interpret the Bible all by myself. No guarantee. Not unless God is in it. And if you're negative to certain things and you don't want to believe certain things, well, then see, you end up making statements like this. We don't know who these are. I know who they are. They're angels. That's real evident. Well, they are absolutely incorrect to suggest that this is simply a human. And he even suggests that it's the same one from Mark 14:51. And if you remember that verse, it's where there was a young man wearing nothing but a linen sheet, runs off when they're trying to arrest Jesus, and escapes naked. And he said, well, this could be this same guy. No, it's not. I mean, it's astonishing, really, what you see in otherwise, you know, intelligent, scholarly people. But again, it gets down to volition. And if you're not positive and you don't want to know the truth, God can keep it from you. And that's why we're told, be careful how you listen and be careful what you listen to. Because it can get you into trouble. Well, he bases it simply on this term neoniskos because it's used in both places. Well, this is wrong for several reasons. The first is that this person demonstrates he has knowledge of what the women think, feel, and what they're doing there in the first place. He demonstrates supernatural knowledge. This isn't some just young guy standing out there suddenly, you know, that knows all this. Secondly, it would be in complete contradiction to Matthew's account, which clearly indicates that an angel made this pronouncement to the women. See, although Luke's account identifies these two as men as well, it would be very unusual for the women to respond with posture of worship before somebody they thought were mere humans. That would be odd. You don't typically assume, in the ancient world, you don't assume that posture of humility and worship generally before people. You might, in some high government official or something, but just some ordinary guy out there in the garden tomb. I mean, why would you do that? And they appear to worship. Indeed, while Luke's account refers to them as men, they appear to be men that suddenly materialized inside the tomb and whose garments are otherworldly. The participle astropto, dazzling, functions as a qualifying adjective. And it is used only one other time, and it means to flash as brightly as lightning. Well, you know how bright lightning flashes. You've seen lightning, you have some sense of it. And in Luke 17:24, where it's used, for just like the lightning, when it flashes out of one part of the sky and shines to the other part, so will the Son of Man be in his day. In other words, you're not going to be able to miss it. That's the whole point of the second advent. People won't look around and say, well, what happened? They'll know when the second advent comes. It will be. But this idea of flashing, and then when you look in Luke's account of this angel and their clothing in 24 there, they've translated as dazzling. Two men suddenly stood near them in dazzling clothing. So, I mean, this is bright, like would light up the cave that they're in, the tomb. So, again, this is only used one other time, and it has the idea of some extreme brightness. So, 23, the three synoptic gospels all indicate that the clothing of the angels was very bright. The tomb would have been poorly lit, and nothing is said about the women carrying a lamp or light of some sort. If they did, it's not mentioned. So, again, while they appear to have gotten up before dark and began all this, it makes some sense that they waited until it was starting to dawn before they would have actually gone out. Because they get there early. But again, I'm thinking if they're in Jerusalem, you're not talking about a big trip. I mean, you're talking about a 10-minute walk maybe. Maybe not even that. I mean, we really don't know how far they were away from all of this. But there's no indication, you know, that they were going out there with torches or whatever to light their way. Because other places that we saw, you know, when it was dark and certain things, torches and lamps and fires are mentioned that people used them. Well, 24, Mark simply describes his outer garment, a robe, as being bright or white. While Matthew describes the clothing as white as snow, Luke is the most expressive as he describes them dressed in dazzling clothing. In 25, it would appear that when the angels manifested themselves to the Roman soldiers, assuming there was more than one that did manifest himself, we're only told about the one sitting on the rock, but we don't know. They manifested themselves with considerably more of their angelic glory than they did when they appeared to the women. Because that's mentioned by Ben back in Matthew 28:3, where it only mentions, I believe, one there. It does. But his appearance was like lightning and his clothing as white as snow. Well, there's nothing in these other accounts that contradicts that all these angels didn't have similar type clothing, that their clothing all was similar. Well, 26, this makes some sense in that their purpose for the soldiers was to shock and awe. And they did it. And they didn't just talk about shock and awe, they did it. Their purpose for the women was to inform, console, and instruct. So they have different reasons for what they're doing there. Just as, you know, the angels don't, again, they have their instructions and their what they're supposed to be doing, their marching orders. And for the soldiers, it was to over, you know, their appearance was designed to scare the daylights out of them. Or at least one of them was, and we can say for certain, not to say that there weren't others there. But it was designed to frighten them to death, and which they did, succeeded. But that's not why they're there for the women. They're not there to scare the women. They're there to help the women and to instruct them with things that they need to know. Okay, well, we're going to have to stop there today. It is our month to observe the Lord's table, so we will get everything in place for that. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to study these things as we continue to observe the ritual that you have established. We pray that you would bless us in that regard, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.